Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, June 21st, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be the host today. We had last Sunday, a very extraordinary conference which took place in New York City of the Schiller Institute, which was organized by Helga Zepp LaRouche, who was the founder of the Schiller Institute. And this conference was in commemoration of its 30th anniversary. And in those 30 years, what we've seen has been an extremely dramatic development of the necessity for the Schiller Institute, as Helga conceived of it back in 1984. We see on the one side the destruction of nations, the deployment of Dark Age barbarism, the lack of any commitment to classical culture, classical science, tossing into a scrap heap of the younger generations, and at the same time a commitment to war, whether it's the barbaric ISIS terrorists marching in the towns and shooting people in cold blood, beheading them, or the kind of sophisticated manipulation of NATO, which is deploying Nazi thugs with the intention of creating a thermonuclear confrontation with Russia. Now, counter to that is this idea of a world without war, based on a higher conception of culture. And in the build-up to this conference, there's been a significant discussion underway on the whole question of what happened beginning in the 20th century to culture. And you have two events that Lyndon LaRouche has pointed to as crucial for the triumph of this bestial Dark Age culture, one of which is the 1900 intervention by Hilbert to mathematicize science in collaboration with Bertrand Russell to destroy the idea that science is based on creative discovery of individual human minds and to reduce science to kinetic relationships that can be measured through mathematical terms. And that the universe, in fact, according to this Russellite view, because this is really Bertrand Russell, Hilbert was just one of the foot soldiers of this operation, the Russellite view is that there is no continuing creativity. There is only the eternal control by the empire, and everyone else has to remain stupid. Now, besides Hilbert's intervention in 1900, the other event was the death of Johannes Brahms. And this occurred in 1898, and after Brahms, maybe 97, David will correct me on this, but after the death of Brahms, you had a brief period with Dvorak, but you had a clamping down, a destruction, which was already underway, and in fact had been underway from the beginning of the development of classical culture with Johann Sebastian Bach, but to destroy the method of composition, which had a continuity from Bach through Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert, Schumann, and Brahms as the main figures. But that commitment to the classical composition was under attack always. And with the death of Brahms, the triumph of various forms of irrational music, whether it's the Schoenberg system, the so-called modernism, or even what was deployed against Brahms during his lifetime, Wagner and Liszt. So we're going to be discussing that on the program today because this is a strategic question. How we think, how human beings think, and how they're given an education on these kinds of principles, or rather have that denied to them, is what will determine the outcome of events over the next two generations, assuming we survive this period today and have two generations to establish classical culture and science. So joining me today is an old collaborator of mine who's been working for many, many years on classical culture, written numerous articles for Fidelio magazine, for the Executive Intelligence Review, including articles on the intersection of science and culture with his work on the Mendelssohns and Riemann. So I'm very happy to have joining us today a string musician who's part of the and David, forgive me, but is it the Schiller Institute Quartet? Is that what you guys are called?
We got renamed as the Dirichlet Quartet.
Dirichlet Quartet, okay. So joining me is David Shaven. And David, welcome to the program.
Always a pleasure, Harley.
So David and I have been talking over the last couple of days about the significance of Lyndon LaRouche raising this issue of Brahms. And in looking at it, what's clear is that Brahms was not just a continuation of this classical tradition stretching back to Bach and a conscious continuation of that, but intersecting the incredible political and scientific developments in the second half of the 19th century in his native Germany. So I think that's where we should start. And let me just throw out a broad question to start with, David, but give us this your sense, since you've written on this and spoken about it quite a bit, your sense of the necessity of an intersection between science and culture.
Oh, goodness. I mean, Lynn's point on listing the death of Brahms with the assault on science by Hilbert and Russell just centers in on pretty much what our enemies sort of know, or know in a feral sort of way, that the deep-rooted optimism that comes from the joy in properly done classical music is not really a different emotion than the deep-seated optimism that a scientist has to have in pushing the frontiers of science and developing a new scientific language. That's where economics comes from. That's really the core of Lynn's 4 points that we're hitting Congress with now.
Well, and this is something which, if you try to reduce things to mathematics or symbolism or logic, you take away that creative impulse, which is the basis of discovery, whether it's discovering something new in a contrapuntal theme or something new about the relationship of the planets in the solar system.
Exactly. I mean, this goes back to Euclid, when there are actually discoveries from Pythagoreans and Platonists on what you call maybe synthetic geometry, or the physical boundary conditions that determine the things that we bump into as phenomena, and you get some formalist, some Hilbert Russell type like Euclid, just saying, let me give you the set of rules that summarizes everything else. That we're all, what it's really the dirty underlying theme there is, we're all fundamentally stupid. We would never actually be able to gain insight and change who we are in terms of figuring out what these discoveries' implications are for the physical world and the world that we live in. And instead, they're just some priesthood someplace that sets down what the rules are. And if you want to get somewhere, you'll learn those rules and try to keep down any nagging questions. You know, just repress those nagging questions. And if you don't mind, it sort of gets right into what Brahms' unique role as a 20-year-old, what I'm claiming he had to face with Liszt and Wagner.
Sure, that's a good place to start.
I'm sure that every great composer has had big decisions he had to make as a young man as to the type of fight he would make. I don't want to denigrate any of those things. But it was just a very ugly, ugly, ugly situation. About 1850, Brahms is 17 years old then. He's a very talented pianist in Hamburg. What's happened is that Felix Mendelssohn and his 20-year effort to revive European culture from the late 1820s through 1847, when he died, by taking the highest peak of composing from Bach and Beethoven and trying to bring that back alive. What had happened is this repressive backward Congress of Vienna in 1815 had sort of tried to clamp down Europe so they would not participate with the United States in a proper American Revolution. So then in 1847, Mendelssohn dies at an early age. I think he's 38. His very young colleague, Joseph Joachim, who I think is about 17 at that time, he'd been with Mendelssohn for 5 years, is, you know, he he's the hope for the future, but he's very young. And Brahms and meets Joachim 6 years later in 1853 at Göttingen. And Brahms is a young man, a pianist of 20. He's on tour with a violinist named Eduard Remenyi. And they happen to meet. It turns out, actually, they meet up because Remenyi had been a young student of Beethoven's violinist, Böhm, and so had Joachim, young meaning like 8 or 10 years old, back in the late 1820s. And Böhm was the Beethoven's preferred violinist for his late quartets. So there was a nice reason Remenyi sought out on this tour Joachim. But Joachim likes Brahms a lot more than this wild Remenyi and his sort of romanticist type of playing. And Brahms and Joachim hit it off. But what they've been looking at for the last 6 years is Franz Liszt and Wagner as the big up-and-coming names. There's a wave of cultural cynicism because of the 1848 revolution, which was just as bad or worse than the French Revolution 50, 60 years earlier. Just a lot of anger and rage with no real solutions being put on the table.
And Wagner actually participated in Dresden on the barricades, throwing rocks and bombs, and he had to flee from the authorities because this is partly the anarchistic rage, the attempt to not build a positive culture but to destroy it.
Yeah, evidently he was part of a bomb plot with Bakunin. Fellow collaborators all got arrested with long jail sentences, but Wagner got the heck out of there. And the first place he fled to was this fancy castle in Weimar, where Liszt and his paramour, Countess Sayn Wittgenstein. So he's got nothing against wealthy people, and he's on the lam with their support for several years in his early part of his career.
But at that point, I think it's important to note, they were already adherents to what they were calling the New German School.
Right.
In direct opposition to the classical tradition that I identified starting with Bach.
What had happened is Mendelssohn's collaborator, Schumann, was, after Mendelssohn's death, he was a pallbearer at the funeral, and he was progressively isolated. And the journal that he had set up, this Neue Zeitschrift für Musik, had been taken over. Schumann was no longer the head of it. And this fellow named Brendel, a Wagnerian, Hennegelian, explicitly attacked in a major article in 1845, attacked Schumann, saying, you know, you're hanging around, you're being too much influenced by the Mendelssohn and the Jews. And Mendelssohn is sort of like Schiller. He's a representative of the perfect classicism. And of course, according to Hegel, history marches on ineluctably. And just because it's the perfect classicism, it has nothing to say to us today if we're concerned about the future, because that was just some other time. And so Schumann is much more innate, Germanic, inward, emotional feelings. And we have to get in touch with that. And that's what Schumann should stay with and not let this Mendelssohn stuff infect him. Had no effect upon Schumann while Mendelssohn was alive. Didn't have effect on him afterwards either. But the same editor, Brendel, the same publication, published an anonymous essay in 1850 on Jewishness in music. It turns out it was written by our buddy Wagner. And it's a much more nasty attack. He denied it was about Mendelssohn, but later on he says explicitly in discussions with Cosima, and Cosima's his wife's diaries reflect this. Of course this was about Mendelssohn. And it's very horrifying. These are two young men, Joachim and Brahms. I think Joachim is 2 years older. He's a much more experienced concert artist when Brahms is unknown in 1853 when they meet. But all the Mendelssohn tradition is on the defensive. Schumann is ill and isolated. And it's not sure what a future holds. Are you supposed to, as young men, accept that this music of the future represented by Liszt and his protege, Wagner, that this is this is just the way the world is. So who are you to challenge the axioms of what we're presenting to you?
Well, David, I think it's worth pointing out to our listeners that this kind of fight was not new. There were critics of Bach who were making the same attacks on his method 100 years earlier. In their criticisms and their attacks, saying that it's the old music, it's pedantic, it's dull, it's too complicated. And so you've had this tradition of fight from the outside to destroy classical culture. And you know, it really rested on the hands, on the shoulders of a couple of people. In this case, I think this is one of the reasons that Schumann became ill, that it was clear to him that he and his wife were pretty much alone. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, Brahms came into their life at that point while Schumann was still had a little bit of time left to join them and take up that tradition.
Yeah, there's always been these attacks. That's true. I guess my only argument is since those attacks against Bach in the 1730s, 20s and 30s, there had been a massive renaissance in music triggered by Bach with Mozart and Beethoven. So the reality of the situation was, you know, beauty and lawfulness. You could make a American revolutions all around the world. So the viciousness of, I skipped over some of the details, but let's just say a little bit of what Wagner's essay really says.
Yeah.
He says that, quote, "So long as the separate art of music had a real organic life need in it, there was nowhere to be found a Jewish composer. Only when a body's inner death is manifest do outside elements win the power of lodgment in it, yet merely to destroy it. Then indeed that body's flesh dissolves into a swarming colony of insect life. But who in looking on that body's self would hold it still for living?" So this is, you know, German culture's stagnant and deserves to die with these, you know, this Jewish outside maggot element, unless you actually, you know, save yourself by going with Liszt and Wagner.
Uh-huh.
I'll just get to the core of it. He attacks everything in this essay, but a lot of people don't recognize his basic attack is against Germany itself as the best cultural background for Europe going forward at that point. Wagner claims that his work was written, quote, "to explain to ourselves the involuntary repellence possessed for us by the nature and personality of the Jews, so as to vindicate that instinctive dislike which we plainly recognize as stronger and more overpowering than our conscious zeal to rid ourselves hereof." I asked the question in the in essay I did on this, you know, how many insults can you possibly count in that one sentence? He starts off with, you know, obviously Jewish nature is alien, but that's just the start off.
Yeah.
Germans have an involuntary repellence. That's just a fact of life. And the fact there was a timeout period when we had the culture of Bach and Mozart, Moses Mendelssohn, Beethoven, Goethe, Schiller, that's just been an artificial aiding of our suppression. We tried to suppress our inward true nature, but that really is not going to work. So it's, there were attacks in Bach's period, in Mozart's period, but they never will. I don't think that'll always be the case. But the character of this thing for a couple of isolated 20, well, let's get right to what you're leading to. Schumann, several months before he finally cracks and jumps off a bridge on October 1st of 1853, Joachim has guided Brahms to go visit the Schumanns. Schumann marks in his diary, "Brahms visits a genius."
Mm-hmm.
Clara, who just found out that same day that she was pregnant with Schumann's last child. If I can find this. She has a beautiful comment in her diary. Sorry, I'm flipping through this one. You want me to go ahead and just do a butchered version of it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, here, I found it. Fine.
Yeah.
A quote, "Here again is one of those who comes as if sent straight from God." They just have a great time for several weeks playing music, learning Brahms' compositions. Brahms is not known to anybody. And Schumann writes in a public announcement that the genius has arrived who will save Germany and save our culture and save music. And, you know, it's a big onus to put on Brahms' shoulders. But it's quite clear, you know, there's no doubt that this is what Schumann had been preoccupied and worried about for years. So the, you know, Brahms hears that from Schumann, but over the next 2 or 3 years, Brahms realizes, especially with the tragedy of Schumann jumping off a bridge and spending his last 2 years hospitalized in a sanatorium, that the truth and beauty is what they think it is, but it's a very ugly, nasty world that he's walked into it as a very young man, and so he forms an alliance with Joachim to master Bach and to save Western civilization, to put it simply. And the rest of his career, the next 40 years of composing, you know, Brahms is quite a unique fellow. People try to categorize one thing or another, but he delivers the most profound truths with such unsettling beauty that it's almost like hearing a voice from some other world. And I think Brahms had oriented his character that way.
Go ahead. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, and this is part of the story on Clara. I'm sure it's a side. You know, Brahms, as a young man, is in love with Clara after Schumann has died. People can skirt around the issue, but not in love in a silly way. He'd grown up very quickly. The two-year period when Schumann's in a sanatorium, Brahms keeps his career on hold and allows Clara to go performing to help support her family, and he stays to watch the kids, and he takes care of Schumann's library. He says Mendelssohn had a wonderful education as a child, something that Brahms had not been able to get as a relatively poor family. But those 2 years in Schumann's library, he mastered Bach, Aeschylus, Schiller, Shakespeare. He patterned himself after Schumann. He realized what it... He said he worked incredibly hard as a young adult to gain what Mendelssohn had just naturally been born into. But he recognized what had to be accomplished. People say a lot of silly things about the relationship of Brahms and Clara, but this was a true platonic relationship. They did love each other, but there was nothing about that had to result in marriage, and they had a profound love for each other, intimate love for each other in their music, and they were bound together in trying to save Western civilization.
Well, and David, I think at this point it's worthwhile just taking a look at the bigger picture in which they were operating, because as we pointed out earlier, you had the failure of the 1848 revolutions, and that was a period of quite a bit of emigration from Germany. But then you had a shift occur in the 1860s with the unification of Germany under Bismarck, and this was... In the midst of this, you had this fight going on of what was the real nature of the future German music. Where would it go? Would it be Wagner, or would it be Brahms, Schumann, and so on? And this fight was really clear, I think, in the 1860s, where it was clear to Brahms that he had a major role to play. And I'd like to pick that up with a discussion of... something that you and I have been talking about, this question of the German Requiem that came out in 1868, and I'd like your thoughts on that.
Well, a lot of Germans did leave Germany in 1848, and they fought for the Union and Lincoln. And this had a big remoralizing effect on Europe. The nationalists in Germany around Bismarck in the late 1860s, you know, Germany was a lot of principalities. It was not unified. It had been manipulated for centuries based upon the egos of these princes and principalities, you know, in I don't know how many dozens, scores of different little duchies.
Hundreds,
okay.
Yeah.
What was happening was there's a lot of complexities, and I'm not the master on Bismarck, but it certainly was a threat to a 50-year lockdown of Europe under the 1815 Congress of Vienna and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire, and the French with the British coordinating this whole little game on the continent. So this was this rise of nationalism in Germany in the late 1860s was the context that you have Brahms composing a German requiem, which he meant as a German requiem, and not just because it was in the German language as opposed to a Latin requiem, but because he was going to address Germany the way Schiller thought about the formation of the United States, that what civilization needed was a situation where a person could be a patriot of their country and a citizen of the world simultaneously. And Brahms even later said that his German Requiem could just as well have been entitled a human Requiem, without giving up on the fact that there's a specific historical character that ties it exactly to Germany being unified and breaking up the unification of Germany is not a Germany, just a Germany issue. And Brahms certainly saw it that way. As we talked earlier, you know, the whole Wagner insistence on breaking down the classical method is just a feudal oligarchic control that the listeners do not have minds that can be risen to a higher level. They are a bundle of passions, and you manipulate those passions. And you know, Wagner's political associations with these Middle Europa, these medievalists in Germany at the time, is pretty well documented. These are the people who wouldn't mind of trying to turn Bismarck into a stupid nationalist, but they would never able to get away with that. Tony Jenkins written some on the influence of Henry Carey and the Civil War, and Bismarck's lessons from that, I think, kept him out of the grasp of some of Wagner's friends.
Well, I think what's important to you go back a little bit. Brahms said that his initial idea for the Requiem, the German Requiem, came from Schumann, that it's something that Schumann had wanted to do, but he was unable to do. And so Brahms periodically looked at it, but it was in 1868 that it was completed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's different from the Latin text Requiems. It was actually put together with a number of passages from the Luther translation of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the tradition, the way he does it, again, makes this connection directly to the religious music of Bach and also Mozart, in that it's ecumenical, and it's about a higher conception of man. Because it starts, the opening words are, "Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted." So it's for the living. It's not for the dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's for the living to carry on this the tradition. And then what is that tradition? Well, it is this idea that's summarized near the very end of the piece in the sixth chorus, where it quotes from Corinthians, "Death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory?" Again, this idea that death is not the end, that we live for a higher purpose. And where is that purpose embodied? In a nation built on principle,
mm-hmm.
or in a world that's built on principle. And mm-hmm. I think this is where you see the difference between what was going on with Wagner and his crew at that time, because the same year that this was performed, in 1868, Wagner's premiere of the Die Meistersinger von Nuremberg, mm-hmm. which was a glorification of the guild structure and the medieval period and the idea when the world was fixed and everyone knew their place, and you know, there really was no purpose to living. And going back into, as you call them, the medievalists, this was Wagner's conception of what Germany should be.
In the same sense as this pre-Raphaelite movement in art, you had this pre-Bach movement, because they were celebrated as the simple counterpoint is ridiculed in the Meistersinger. The Meistersinger, they had these natural dramatic impulses, and you get these, you try to get any learning into that with actual, you know, principles, and it's sort of this, you have this formalistic counterpointist, you know, which is repressing our creativity. So you have this, that was 1868, you were saying?
1868, the same year.
Yeah.
Yeah, both of them came out that year. And look, I think the other important thing is that Wagner had he despised the German Requiem of Brahms. In fact, several years later in discussing it, he was talking about what would happen when his generation dies. And he said, we will want no German Requiem to be played to our ashes.
Right.
So a complete and open attack on that. But I think
he's partly upset because the German Requiem was a major success. People responded to that.
One thing on that really quickly, which is I think also quite important, is that the argument against Brahms from Wagner and others is that it's the same old music, that with no real change, that pedantic, boring. And, you know, what were they objecting to? The idea that there's a lawful ordering or a lawful necessity in music, but that you can approach that with individual creative freedom. Mm-hmm. So that even operating within the framework of classical counterpoint, you can create something new and beautiful, which comes from the minds playing around with these principles. And that's what you see rejected by Wagner and also by the Russellites and Hilbert.
Right. And it's empirically proven that that level of creativity does exist. When you were reading through, when you were giving a little quick summary of some of the content of the Requiem, German Requiem, you know, I was thinking about Lincoln's Gettysburg Address in terms of the mm-hmm. importance of
the living,
getting people to think about
yeah.
our mortality and the type of sacrifices that are made, and to take it seriously, but not to get maudlin about it, and to think about what is their mission. This question of classical music is partly, can you are people capable of taking such a terrifying and large thought and dealing with it, and you know, becoming a better person from having dealt with it? And I think both the German Requiem and the Gettysburg and the second inaugural all have that quality at that time. I think just a small point. You know, people look, I think it's the fourth movement of the German Requiem. I may be wrong about that. Well, it harkens back to Brahms' studies of some of Schumann's music, which he had tinkered with some of that material since back in 1854. So I think that some people say that the German Requiem was occasioned because Brahms' mother passed away in 1865, and I'm sure that causes the appropriate
reflections. That brought him back to the theme, but he had been right. thinking about it since discussions with Schumann in 1953.
Absolutely. And what he owed Schumann, I think that's
yeah.
what formed Brahms, is that, anyhow. So yeah, I think that's very key. And the you know, it's not as well known, this triumph lead that is for baritone and chorus and orchestra was evidently fairly often performed. I've never heard a live performance of it. Evidently, it sort of got pushed down when Germany got pushed down, when the manipulations of World War I in the 20th century.
Well, the Triumph Lied was written in 1872 on the occasion of the German victory in the Franco-Prussian War.
It published them, but it was actually 1870-71 as they're winning.
Yep.
Different parts of the Triumph Lied are composed
right.
as history's being made. and it's performed in 1871 is upon the occasion of the victory.
And Brahms himself called it, even though it was dedicated officially to Wilhelm I, who was the Kaiser, he personally called it his Bismarckgesang,
yeah,
the song for Bismarck.
Right. The last book that Brahms was reading when he passed away in 1897 was this book by Busch on Bismarck. Busch was the confidant of Bismarck from 1870 to 1890, when Bismarck was pushed out of office. And I've never read Busch's works on Bismarck, but Brahms seemed, that was the last book he called for when he could barely read, when he was in not good shape. And I know that he had after Bismarck had been pushed out of government in 1890, something that Lynn has identified as the beginning of the downfall leading into World War I.
Well, Lynn describes it as the beginning of World War I,
right,
not the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand, which is, we're about to celebrate the 100th anniversary of that in a couple of days.
Right.
But that, what I mean, just in terms of this Bismarck question, there was in Germany in that period a new optimism, especially not just after the reunification or the unification, but after the shift in policy, the break with free trade, the break with the British Empire that was carried out by Bismarck at the end of the 1870s, directly in collaboration with the networks in Germany promoting the works of American economist Henry Carey, who had been Lincoln's economist.
Mm-hmm.
And you had this development, which included, it's interesting because incorporated, part of the unification of Germany was what had kept Germany apart previously, was you had the religious warfare of the so-called 30 Years' War. You had Protestants versus Catholics, you had regionalism, and this idea of some universal principle of nation, of culture. And the German Requiem, one of the key things about that is that what Brahms wanted to do was to speak of these universal truths from the Bible, but in his native tongue and culture, appropriate for his culture, mm-hmm, to uplift people to these higher principles. And this is exactly what Bismarck's policy, which today we might call solidarity, the development of the social welfare state, this is what was celebrated by people like Clara Schumann and Brahms. And on Bismarck's 70th birthday, I just found this quote today, he wrote to a friend who had been writing to him about Bismarck. This was in 1885. Brahms wrote, "Truly, we are witnessing and seeing personalities, conditions, and men such as history has never seen before." So it was that kind of optimism,
mm-hmm,
which, if you think about it, what was Brahms doing from the period of unification up through 1885, 86? That's when he composed his four symphonies, mm-hmm, among other things. And there was a whole, you know the chronology better than I do, but there was a whole burst of creative activity by Brahms in that period.
Absolutely. This is the American Revolution breaking out in Europe. It's everything you can say about the industrial development, the electrification, but this changes, it sort of throws away all the stupid debates about whether man is, you know, creative or not. You just put the mission in front of the country and you find out all those people that were peasants and could not learn their own language and never would utter more than 500 words in their life. It turns out those were human beings all along. They're totally capable of rising above what their fathers and mothers did. Their fathers and mothers lived for that opportunity to have their kids do better than they did. The public education, having a social welfare state where the state knows that it's not a matter of a giveaway program, it's a matter of if you expect more from your population, there's certain minimum standards that you do not only for charity, you do it because it's the only intelligent thing to do. You're stupid if you try to have a bunch of peasants around just to carry food to the castle. You know, so this period, it's earth-shaking. The world would certainly have been a different place if the machinations that forced Bismarck out had not occurred. Brahms was probably the key cultural leader throughout the 1870s and 1880s. And this is partly the hatred of the Wagnerites and the Liszt crowd, and why LaRouche can say something really wild. You know, he's saying to people, to our audience, and to the world, you don't know, you're not having a proper dialogue with beauty for 110, 120 years since Brahms died. Or to the extent we go back and listen to Mozart and Bach and Beethoven and Brahms, we can take something from that, but there's an edgy, unsolved problem there. Is why aren't we creating those modern Brahmses today? There's something sick. There's something backward about our culture.
Let's take it a step further. This comes to the question that was posed in the webcast last night by Lyndon LaRouche, which is, why is it when it's now apparent to everyone that we're on a course toward war, whether it's Iraq or Ukraine? We're on a course toward the bail-in, which means the end of the financial system as we know it. We're at the end of the Obama era because Obama is highly unpopular. His polls are so bad that even one of his sycophants, Chuck Todd of MSNBC, is saying, your presidency is over. Mm-hmm. And yet Obama's still in office, and the American people are sitting around swearing at him but doing nothing. And this is where classical culture, which gives people a connection to the beautiful in man, actually increases the intolerance for this kind of ugliness. And that's what's missing in our culture, I think. Whereas what Wagner does is create these larger-than-life mythologies, which are not so different from such things as Tolkien's Lord of the Rings or the Harry Potter series, where people have to look outside of the world and outside of reality for entertainment and titillation. And they're missing the fact that you have an empire that's crushing them while they're engaged in masturbatory fantasies about these non-existent worlds.
Exactly.
And I think this is what Helga got at in her discussion at the conference this last weekend, which I'd like you to just report on a little bit, the intersection of music and politics, especially the Nania discussion that came from Helga, because that is this question of how do you make the beautiful something that's living in people's lives.
Helga and John Sigerson had collaborated in assigning the Brahms' setting of Schiller's poem Nania. They really work quite well. I mean, Helga gave a very succinct, beautiful encapsulation. I'm not going to do that one. It's people can go to the site, the Schiller site, and listen to what she has to say. But Nania is a short poem by Schiller. It's 14 lines. I think it's got to be modeled after a Shakespeare sonnet structure, 4, 4, 4, and 2. And the last two lines, which are always have such power in the Shakespeare sonnets, have the same thing in this. This is, that which is beautiful must die, is stated, you know, from the beginning of the poem. And I won't go through the whole poem, but however, a Klanglied, a funeral song on the lips of a beloved is divine. The link that we mortals have to immortality is actual beautiful creative actions. To put it another way, nobody's going to set a poem of Schiller's on where an act of creativity is the driving force, unless the work of art itself is, it's a very high standard. That work of art that addresses that the subtleties of that poem has to be on that level or even higher. It has to be a successful act of creativity.
That was the point that Beethoven made nearly a century earlier.
On Schiller versus Goethe.
Problem setting Schiller's poetry.
Exactly. So the ability to have people reflect, simply just take one little element at the end of when the divine is repeated, the Herrlich. In a curious way, he actually has the chorus end speak the last word. It's repeated several times, and then actually ends fairly abruptly. It's not li, it's just li, and then just the sound of the orchestra holding. And people, just one element there, people can reflect upon how there's something even before the power of speech in terms of the poetic workings of the mind, which is real. It's not something that it's you're going to touch. It's not tangible, but it's and even what you, so Brahms had a very, let me pull back. This is 1880 or 1881 or so, I think, when he composes this. A friend of his died, a painter named Feuerbach, and he, the occasion of this thing is dedicated to the mother of the painter who died before his time. But this is much how Brahms sees his role, that that yes, you are creative, and we're not being formalist or doctrinaire about saying that. Even if this poem demands a certain incredibly high standard to be set, we're going to take on those challenges. And to jump to the four serious songs of Brahms' last year, which were composed, I think it's quite fair to say he's got Clara Schumann much on the mind, because his dearly beloved Clara has just died in May of 1896.
Yeah.
And that certainly the most beloved person he's known in his lifetime is not there in body anymore. So he takes all those three stanzas of the first three of the four serious songs, you know, quite seriously in terms of mortality and death and all the things that can bring us down. He doesn't, to get to the setting of the Corinthians and the underlying role of agape, he doesn't just tinkle on the scene and say we should all be nice and lovely to each other. He's very serious in terms of forcing people to get to the bottom of all their problems, to realize at their core they are, there's a very deep-rooted optimism. And this is probably when he knows that all the political options for Germany and Europe on the table are not looking very good at that time, and he's not going to live that much longer himself. So I think what happened at this conference, a lot of people who wonder what this LaRouche movement is about, what is the power of this old Lyndon LaRouche fellow who doesn't hold office, what intellectual collaborators of his from Sergei Glazyev and Putin's advisor, and a whole host of others, what do they see in this guy? And when they all have to bring their expertise on the different games of the oligarchy and games of pushing us into war, and they have moral outrage against this, and they know it's wrong, they see a movement lead with living proof of what the character of human beings are and on what level you have to intersect and intervene on that population. I saw
this
with
David. That's precisely when I've interviewed Helga repeatedly on this program before, when we always get into this question of how terrible the world looks right now and how it's moving into one crisis after another. Where's the optimism come from? And that's what she's always come back to, that you have to look to your own mind and your own soul and your fight to improve yourself, to make yourself less imperfect, and that poetry and music are two of the most important tools, mental qualities or mental practices that can improve the higher quality of morality, that is morality that coincides with the immortality of the species. And I think that's, we see that with Brahms, we see that with Mozart. Interestingly, you know, many people wonder, did Mozart know he was about to die when he wrote his Requiem? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's an irrelevant question. These great artists lived with that as a sense of who they are, mm-hmm. knowing that life is short, your time here is fragile, and you have to do with it what you can for the higher purpose of the species, not for your own benefit. And, you know, I think that's what is so touching in the discussion around the Nania, what the beautiful must die, but what survives. It's the potential to create constantly higher qualities of beauty.
Yeah, this classical, I mean, one way of just defining what this classical method is, going back to Kuza and Kepler, is that being made in the image of our Creator is not just a pleasant phrase. It implies everything about both music and science, that the individuality, particularity, is not dead matter, that the Creator would not have made a world that way. Even if we can look around and see a lot of, you know, dirt on the ground, the what Brahms represented that the oligarchy hated was that you can use your time on Earth to make the world in our image, and our image is in the image of our Creator, and the processes of the universe. Well, just less corny about it. You know, it's just weird that people don't want to think this about Kepler, but, you know, he's saying that the processes that form the solar system and the processes by which we hear the harmonic array of music, and a very subjective thing, and the way the solar system is organized is the same process. And that should, once people really dig into that, that should be a rather eerie feeling about who we really are. And instead of getting frozen about, you know, that and getting mystical about it, it sets certain tasks that they God is on our side if we are willing to go to the godly part of ourselves and not cut a deal with all the temptations of the world. That we have what it takes to be able to accomplish what has to be accomplished, even if the bookmakers in Las Vegas don't think so. And I think that came across at the conference. Sometimes you can say all the right things, and you know, some things come out of decent conferences. This one was a very thoroughly composed conference.
Well, and that's available on the Schiller Institute website. We're going to be putting more of the transcripts out. The next two issues of the Executive Intelligence Review will have many of the transcripts. You'll get a chance to see it. For those who joined us late, let me identify. I'm talking with David Shaven. This is the LaRouche Show for June 21st, 2014. And we're taking up a subject which is dear to Lyndon LaRouche's heart, but which many people get confused about, which is the relationship of classical culture and strategic thinking. And we've been talking about the case of Johannes Brahms. I think, David, in the last few minutes we have remaining, you know, one of the things to take up is that, you know, the people who came after Brahms, there's the famous case of Schoenberg, who tried to make the argument that Brahms was moving in his direction. I think it was Schoenberg who did that. The attempt to say that Brahms was the first modern composer. But what you find in the complexities of Brahms is much more a continuation of what you find in the late quartets of Beethoven than anything with the decisive break from that classical tradition that you see after Brahms and after Dvorak. Now, I'd like you to just comment on that briefly.
You know, to my way of thinking, if a composer has mastered a classical method and then starts taking in all the difficulties of the world, there's no problem in them pushing the boundaries of what's been accepted to have been heard before then. You know, there's a lot of complexities in the world. So, but the way these things get discussed as to whether to go back to simpler things that people understand or to I'm going to go into some bizarre new theory of how I can manipulate notes, the whole discussion is sort of futile. And there's a whole host of, you know, post-classical composers, and you'd almost need a shrink with different psychoanalytical techniques to figure out their different problems. You know, Dvorak was the one you mentioned. I'll say one. It might have been a lonely world for Brahms in the last few years, and especially the last year after Clara died. But one of his, the cellist in the Joachim Quartet, Joseph Joachim had a quartet, and they played for him, for Brahms, just a couple months before he died. The cellist, I think his name was Hausmann, was also a performer of Dvorak's cello concerto. And Brahms wanted him to come to his quarters and play that for him. And it was replayed. Hausmann performed it 1 month before Brahms died in Vienna. And Brahms attended that 1 month before he died. He'd been dying for months. And the population in the concert hall was surprised that they all knew that Brahms was dying. They were surprised he was there. There were two pieces being performed, the Dvorak cello concerto and the Brahms Fourth Symphony. And the audience just stood and cheered, interrupting every movement, forcing Brahms to stand. Huh. And they all knew that this was the last time they were going to see him. And it was the end of an era. And the descriptions of the sustained applause. Well, just on the Dvorak cello concerto, what I wanted to get to on that was Dvorak, at the end of that cello concerto, I think Brahms said about the cello concerto, if I'd known somebody could compose a concerto for the cello like this, I would have done one myself. This was at the very end, I don't get too interpretive about this, but Dvorak's dear sister-in-law had died, the one he had proposed to before his own wife. And you almost hear this beat. I think it's in the timpani at the end of the cello concerto, the heartbeat, slow and then stop. Huh. And then a few seconds later, the orchestra, you have this glorious image of the soul going up to heaven. And I'm not going to use the picture images on these concertos, but it's very clear. It's a very universal message Dvorak has in this, and very celebratory, very heart-wrenching, but also very celebratory. And I well suspect. So what came after Brahms? It's left on the plate for us. I mean, I want to resist any historical description of a few years of Dvorak's life and what he was doing in America. That's a good topic for another show. But when Lynn insists upon the death of Brahms in 1897 and the 1900 Hilbert challenge to formalize mathematics in such a way as to outlaw creativity and science, I think we just keep the edge on that. There's Brahms' whole lifetime for 40 of compositional lifetime was principled beyond one of the most principled characters of the last few hundred years. And I think the fight for people to, if they don't know Brahms' music, some of it's easier to get into than other part of the music, but it's all a fight. People will all be torn in different directions. And it's the most useful, one of the most useful things they can do right now, to make them to stop bellyaching about the one world bankers and all the conspiracies and all the horror shows that they may witness, and actually stop being a victim. Brahms is a really good friend for anybody who decides that their time on earth should be something that their loved ones will sing a funeral song for.
Well, I would recommend that people take up listen to the German Requiem and get the translation, if you don't understand German, of the stanzas in it. And also listen to the last two symphonies of Brahms, which I think are built on the tradition of Bach and Beethoven very consciously and very clearly and very beautifully. And David, we've run out of time. I want to thank you for joining us today and to make sure that our listeners get your friends to listen to this. This will be archived on the LaRouchePub.com, and it's critical that people actually comprehend that how they think is what really is important right now. not what they think, but how they think, and why classical culture is so critical for people to become real thinkers, real strategic thinkers. So, David, thank you for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Harley.
And that will do it for the LaRouche Show for today, the 21st of June, 2014. Join us next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time for the next edition of the LaRouche Show.